thank you for joining us for this episode of The Art of the Score. Tonight's guest is film composer Carter Burwell. Mr. Burwell has carved an indelible niche into the film industry with his ongoing collaboration with the Coen brothers, from Blood Simple all the way to True Grit. He's also a frequent collaborator of filmmaker Spike Jonze, and other scores that populate his resume include Psycho 3, Doc Hollywood, This Boy's Life, Conspiracy Theory, and the Twilight Saga.
I never really thought about doing music for movies. It was actually someone I knew through the band scene in New York was doing some sound editing for a film, and he called me, and he thought that the music I was writing for and that I was playing in clubs like CBGBs, he thought that it might be appropriate to the film. And so he asked if I was at all interested in that, whether I'd like to meet the filmmakers. And I said, something I never thought of before, but I said, sure, I'll try that. So I went and saw some of the film. I didn't have any demonstrations of my work, since I'd never done it before, but I went home, put a few sketches together of ideas for the film, and gave it to filmmakers. And many months later, they called me back and asked me to score their movie. So that turned out to be the Coen brothers' first film, Blood Simple. And when that came out, people just started calling me again. and then the Coens made another film. They made Raising Arizona. And so basically just people started calling me and asking me to do it. It was never an intention of mine. It was fun, and eventually it became, I guess, some sort of a career.
Yeah, well, it's been a really great career, if you ask me. That was the genesis of how you met the Coen brothers, and you continued to work with them, as you said, through the ensuing decades. What was your first meeting like with them? I mean, did you click right off?
we're all about the same age, I guess, at that point, what would we have been? About, 25, something like that. But, sort of just out of college, really. And I think Joel had already been editing films for a while. Ethan, I think, had just graduated from Princeton. And, they're not the kind of people who you walk in the room and there and you immediately feel completely at ease with them, and they're they're just not that kind of person. I'm not either. So I think we're all equally uncomfortable around each other, and that seems kind of, seemed kind of familiar. I don't know how to describe it, but if you ever meet them, you'll understand what I mean. But they're very honest and open about what they do. They just don't seem like the most approachable people at first, but in fact they're in many ways more, how should I put it, genuine than a lot of the people you'll meet in the entertainment industry who seem approachable.
So let's say it seemed a little sort of anxious or whatever, you would have had like immediate sort of strange vibes, and you might not have worked as well together even in those first few moments. But since they were kind of, I would imagine they were sort of, not suspicious, but just sort of like, well, we'll just see how it goes kind of thing. I guess that was something that you were feeling at the same time as well.
It is. And honestly, yeah, you're absolutely right. I prefer the ununctuous, if that's a word. And they, Joel, years later, told me that they interviewed many composers because they, the people who were backing the film didn't want to hire someone who knew nothing about it, which is what I was. They interviewed lots of composers, including people whose names were, well known. And Joel said that these composer interviews were the strangest interviews he's ever had, that no other type of audition has ever seemed as odd to him as the composer ones. And I don't even know exactly what he means, but he found either the composers themselves or the process of talking to a composer to be very off-putting. Mm-hmm. And my wife's theory is that's why they keep hiring me is Joel doesn't want to have to go through that again.
So you're their composer for life.
Yeah, exactly. Well, either that or until they meet another composer, you know.
Right. Well, it doesn't seem like they're looking really, because that's great, because you know whenever I see one of their movies, I'm always assured that there's going to be a Carter Burwell score with it, and that's the way I prefer it. Specific scores with them, you know, first for both Raising Arizona and the Hudsucker Proxy, I just bring those two up first. You lean heavily on the classics for inspiration for those. I mean, there was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony for Arizona, and then I guess a lot of people don't know this one, but Kekachurian's Spartacus Ballet for Hudsucker Proxy, which yeah. I think is one of the, I mean, that whole score is incredible to me, and I didn't even know about the Kekachurian until years later, you know. Do you find you get a lot of inspiration from classical music? And what was it that made you quote so directly from those pieces in those movies?
Well, I'll say right away that in both cases, it actually wasn't my choice, honestly. In Raising Arizona, that little bit of Beethoven's Ninth, it was in there mostly because Pete Seeger had this... this sort of medley of tunes that he called the Way Out There Suite, and he used to perform it, you know, way back in the 60s. I think the Coens knew it from their childhood, and it included all these different things, some Russian folk tunes and Western yodeling and Beethoven's Ninth. It was this odd wry amalgam of every musical genre you can imagine played on banjo and voice. And Joel had, I guess Joel and Ethan had suggested that I listen to that, and that was where the idea of sticking the Beethoven in came from. On Hudsucker Proxy, it was actually our music editor, Todd Cassow, who I was having, on that film, a harder time than usual finding the right tone, and because it's, you know, it takes place in some metropolis, they don't tell you what, but you know, it's a lot could be New York, and some metropolis, and I guess if you had to guess, you'd say maybe it's the 30s or 40s, it's a period thing, but it's also not quite, there's an unreality to the proceedings. So we're having a hard time capturing all those things, the feeling of nostalgia, but the unreality, sort of fantasy aspect. And it was actually Todd Cassow, the music editor, who suggested listening to Kekachurian. And eventually, Kekachurian became a little thorn in my side because that piece, the Spartacus piece, fit the opening scene so perfectly. I was never able to write anything better, and we ended up just using the Spartacus. Which is frustrating to me because I actually did try for a long time to improve upon it, but I was not able to.
Well, I see that as sort of like a harkening back to you know, the composers like Max Steiner and so forth that used to incorporate all sorts of pre-existing tunes, from classical music to standards to traditional songs into their scores as well. Perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. That is the tradition of film music. I mean, silent film accompaniment was almost always that. It was a pastiche of tunes that the people in the audience would have known, and they would have almost have known what to associate them with. Like you'd hear the pianist start up this thing, and you knew that a train was coming, or you know, romance is coming, or danger is coming. You know, and you're right. The tradition of referencing known pieces of music is very much at the heart of film music.
I think it's something that's not really done that much these days, which is unfortunate. I think a lot of composers these days could actually take a cue from that tradition. one of my favorite, this is a personal question here, one of my favorite of your scores is Barton Fink, and that is a score that just exudes this sort of feeling of great mystery and strangeness. What was your reaction to seeing that film for the first time? Because a lot of people are stunned by that film. And how did you approach the score for that particular piece?
Well, I mean, that's one of my favorites, too, as a matter of fact. It might be one of my favorite films of theirs. Originally, Joel told me that he thought maybe there would be no score at all in the film, that it would all be sound effects. And Skip Lise, who's their sound editor, and also the person who introduced me to them in the first place, he was working on these very imaginative, very non-naturalistic sound effects for sound, special sounds for the hotel. The sound of the hotel, has elements of like submarines and jet planes and things like this. He was doing these very hyped up sound effects, and Joel thought that maybe they could do the whole movie with that. They wouldn't need a score. But when I saw the film, when they first played it for me, I did feel that there was an element of Barton's character that I could contribute, which is basically his innocence, or naivete, however you want to put it, and that even though he presents himself as this experienced playwright and from New York City, that in a way he's really a child, and so that was. That gave me the melody. That idea gave me the melody I used for him. And then when Joel saw that, he immediately saw that, oh yeah, this will contribute something important. And then we basically took off from that. And Skip and I very carefully interwove the sound effects and the score so that, in addition to that piano melody that plays Barton, there are times when violins will play very high patterns that are supposed to echo the sound of the mosquito, which is one of the themes in the story, or these low bass trombones will do something that echoes these low tones that the hotel emits. Anyway, that was one of the most interesting things to me about that score, was the collaboration with Skip and how we spotted the film together, and we'd really just divide up the sound spectrum between us, and I'd say, well, I could do I'll do a low drone here, and Skip would say, great, well, because I've got this mosquito sound up here, or I'd say, well, I've got I want to do these banging prepared piano sounds that sound like plumbing, and he'd say, well, okay, because I've got this fighter jet sound I want to put underneath the sink, and anyway, it was really a fun, experience, and I've rarely had a chance to work that closely with the sound designer, but it was great.
Moments in it where the score is almost subliminal, really.
Right,
I know studying your works a lot, Harkening back to what you said about the score for Barton Fink, you know, underlining his character, one of our favorites of your scores is your work for Richard Donner's Conspiracy Theory, which we thought perfectly matched Mel Gibson's, you know, sort of blacked out lead character. Do you find
right.
you get a lot of inspiration from specific performances or specific characters from the films you've worked on?
Very much so, yeah. I have to say it's not so much a plan of mine, but I notice that when I'm working on a film, it will, even though it wasn't planned, I will often end up playing character or being inspired by some aspect of a character. The first time I think I noticed this myself was in Miller's Crossing. There's something about Gabriel Byrne's impassive face and his clear blue eyes that made me think he needs a really sappy, sentimental orchestral score, you know, sort of something exactly the opposite of what I'm seeing. I like the idea that inside that stone face there was a sappy Irishman. But in Conspiracy Theory, it was, you know, honestly, I always, when I read that script, I always saw the movie as being a little darker, a little edgier, and less antically comedic than the way it turned out. Basically, between Dick Donner and Mel Gibson, they injected this comedic element that I felt lessened the impact for me of the movie. But that's what they had. That's what they did, and so I went with that. So some of the themes are there to make it, you know, to just play that, play the sort of silly side of Mel Gibson's character. But honestly, the parts I like the most are the parts where it's a little more dangerous and you don't know what he's going to do next. He's capable of doing anything, you know. That was trying to mix those two. I don't know how successful, honestly, the mix is, but I enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed that project a lot.
Collaboration, you know, along with the Coen brothers, you've collaborated every film with Spike Jonze. What's your relationship like with him and his filmmaking style?
Well, I love Spike, and one of the pleasures in what I do is those opportunities to work with someone on their first feature film, because you know, he called me. I don't know why he called me exactly, but because obviously, you know, he could have worked with any of the bands that he'd done music videos for, but he wanted, for being John Malkovich, he wanted, you know, a score, and I think he wanted to learn what film scoring was, in a way. He wanted to, you know, find out what you can do with a score that's written to the film. So I was very touched that he called me. I love that project, and love working with Skip. He's got a very open mind about how he wants to approach things, and if anything, it's, you know, can get frustrating sometimes that so many possibilities are all considered. So his films tend to be in post-production for a year or more because he wants to try this and he wants to try that and he wants to try all these different things. But, you know, at the same time, it's, you know, it's not that he doesn't have any ideas, it's that he has so many ideas that it can take a long time. And but that's not a bad thing.
Is that freeing for you in a lot of ways, or do you just get overwhelmed or whatever?
Well, I will say that typically I'm more the kind of person who, I would say probably a little bit more like the Coens, where, okay, if I don't have an idea, that's a problem, and but once I have an idea, I tend to, you know, that now I've got a solid concept, and I personally like to commit to it and live in that world, and it's hard after a certain point. If I'm still wandering around and don't have that concept yet, or I'm not sure if that concept's working, it's frustrating. That hasn't really come up with Spike. Maybe a little bit on Where the Wild Things Are. Honestly, it not so much an issue for me. As I know his editors have to deal with it a little more than I do, where they are on editing and re-editing for such a long period of time. Really, I wanted to say about Spike was just that he has such an open mind about how he approaches filmmaking that it's really refreshing. It reminds me of, you know, all the possibilities that are available, which is, you know, it's always very inspiring.
Yeah. Well, at least two of your scores that I know of have been really in close collaboration with other artists. Maybe three, really. I mean, I throw in there T-Bone Burnett for O Brother, Where Art Thou, which I know you provided additional music for, and then also Big Lebowski, also with him as the music supervisor, and then
right.
Karen O for Where the Wild Things Are. How did you guys settle on how you parceled out which parts of the films you'd work on? I mean, what was that process?
Well, on the Coen films with T-Bone, that was largely most of the parts that T-Bone was, you know, had music in, they were there right in the script. Those songs had been written in the script typically, or very early on in the production process. So those spots were all, you know, there for specific.
They were all taken.
Exactly, that's right. So basically, I'm just filling in the, you know, any other spaces that need something, but we're not sure what. In both those cases, especially Big Lebowski, the stuff I did all, you know, was all written to sound like songs, so that you wouldn't be aware at any point that you were listening to score. So that, you know, things I did are, you know, like, I think I have sort of a jazzy film noir detective theme for John Polito's character, and then we have a, you know, a techno theme for the band of nihilists, and, you know, it's all supposed to sound like it's been also dropped in from some other place, the way the Bob Dylan and what have you has.
Mm-hmm.
In O Brother, Where Art Thou, I did so little. but, you know, did a little, you know, a little drum roll here, something there. But again, that film was really, you know, so much about the music and the music, all that music which had been written before I was born. So there wasn't that much for me to do. On Where the Wild Things Are, Spike's original idea was that all the music in the movie would be Karen's, and there wouldn't be any instrumental score. It would all be songs. And when he started cutting it and started looking at it, he began to realize that there were sort of story aspects that weren't coming through that way, that, you know, people weren't sure what was going on at certain times or why or how people, how the characters were feeling. And so at a certain point he called me and asked me to come on. We basically divided up the film about 50-50. I mean, Karen was writing at the same time I was, and as her stuff came in, she was taking certain scenes, and as mine came in, I was taking certain scenes. And there's some scenes where, you know, we were probably both writing for them at the same time, but whoever got there first with something that was working would get it. But it, in the end, it worked out to being about 50-50.
When I see your credit on the film and it's done, I think to myself, wow, I don't remember hearing a lot of the music in this movie. And I mean, like last night, I was, or 2 nights ago, I was watching The Seven Psychopaths, and the same thing happened. Do you prefer kind of an invisible style to your scoring? If someone has that feeling coming out of the movie, is that something that you want to foment?
Well, I mean, sometimes that, you know, invisible is the right thing. And, you know, I've worked on films, and I guess if you do this for a while, everyone has, worked on films at both ends of the spectrum, ones where the music really had to be invisible. If you noticed any score, then that would be something that would be wrong. And then I've also worked on films where the score is just right up front and insists upon its place, like Raising Arizona would be an obvious example. And it really depends upon the film. I mean, some films, in a way, pretend not to be films. You know, the experience of watching the film, you're not supposed to be having an awareness of the editing or an awareness of the filmmaking process. It's supposed to be a little more invisible. And, you know, the most extreme example, in my experience, was No Country for Old Men. We noticed that if you heard anything that sounded like a musical instrument sneaking in with some score, it totally destroyed the tension, and it totally changed the movie for the worse. So in that case, we end up with a solution where you never hear music enter. There is, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes of music score in that film, but you never hear it enter. It's a steady state sound that sneaks in, and it is as invisible, I think, as anything could be. I mean, so, to the point where that gas station scene, you know, I put the stuff I was writing in the key of B natural so that it would match the tone of the electric hum in the room, you know, because that 60 hertz hum is in a, very close to B. So doing everything I can to make it, yeah, really invisible. And so I don't, you know, I think the film determines that rather than me. I will say that I will say one generalization about myself. I like less music rather than more in a movie. When I'm sitting in a film as an audience member, I just prefer not being told how to feel. I prefer to have less information about, you know, emotional, you know, the emotional subject. And that's generally what film score is doing, and I prefer less of it. So I prefer fewer minutes of film score than most people put in. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. I always think that there's, especially these days, I think there's too much music in movies, and the music isn't that memorable too. But the scoring kind of tips us off on too many emotions, like you said, and it's used in place of actually portraying those emotions on screen through the acting or the writing. I find that another criticism of present day movie music for me is that it kind of it's kind of eschewing melody and theme and adds instead as a sort of an adjunct to the sound effects. Now, I know that you do that in collaboration with Skip on some of those films as a conscious effort. Well, would you agree that that's a problem with today's movie music, is that there's not enough melody in it or theme in it?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say that it's a problem with today's movie music, because I think that there are other, you know, not all good music is melodic. You know, I enjoy a lot of 20th century and I guess 21st century music. that is not heavily melodic. And I think it's interesting to have that come into feature film. I myself, as a composer, I am a sucker for a melody, and it's very true. It's something I really enjoy. If I can come up with a melody that's memorable, I pat myself on the back, and that's one of the pleasures of what I do. So when I do a film that doesn't have it, it's true that I'm not having as much fun, and that's just my personal character as a composer. I like a tune, usually a simple tune, but I do like a tune. But I don't think that it's a mistake that there isn't melody in more films. I think that if you're trying to write a melody and it fails to happen, if a film is being scored in some kind of 19th century romantic way, like 50% of films are, and the melody isn't memorable, well, that is disappointing, because if you're trying for a traditional film score and you can't come up with a good tune, I do feel that's just a disappointment to me. But I think it's interesting that people are getting away from that, and that's not my personal style, but it's been true for a while now. I mean, since the 50s, there have been different strains of film music that go away from melody, from 19th century harmony, and I think I think it's interesting. Like I say, I find it harder for me to do that and still feel that I've written a substantial piece of music, but certainly it can be done. People do it.
When I think back on things like Jerry Goldsmith's score for Planet of the Apes, obviously non-melodic
right.
works there very well. So so there's plenty of examples of non-melodic music that works perfectly. One complaint I've read from composers these days is that some of them are not given enough time between a film's final edit and its final mix to explore, all the possible musical possibilities for a film. It might be only a week or 2 weeks or something. Have you encountered this problem in your many films that you've done?
Yeah, you're not kidding. That's absolutely true, and it is. There are always different challenges to the job, but I think that's almost always the number one challenge. I mean, I'm sure no one ever has as much money as they want, and there are other issues, but I feel that the lack of money rarely actually causes a creative. That's not really a creative struggle. Money doesn't bring that on, but the lack of time does. It's true. I really feel that the music could be better if we had more time, and that really does make it hard. It also makes just living life difficult, because I find myself when I'm working on a film more and more just staying up all night, getting a few hours of sleep, and there's no time left for anything else, for seeing my family or anything. So it is it's a real challenge, and I don't know what to say about it. I wish that it were different, but I don't know what would make it different. Back when post was all done on film, that slowed the process down a little, and that gave us a little bit more time. But now that it's done digitally, it's all sped up, and that works well for the financiers, because most films are in some sense budget. They're paid for on debt. The money's borrowed from somewhere, and until you can actually release the film, you're just paying interest. So shortening up the post process is good for them as well, but it's really not good for composers. It is a real problem, and you put it exactly right, that not only is it hard to just write what you have to write in the time allowed, it really doesn't allow for experimentation. There really isn't much time to try something radically different, and so on these really tight schedules, I think there's a natural tendency to just go with what you know, and that's too bad. It makes it hard for things like, you gave a good example, like Planet of the Apes. It makes it hard for people to come up with new sounds and new approaches.
And this is our final question that we ask everybody on the that's participating in this series. It's very simple. If you were to pick three essential film scores out of your outside of your own work, what would they be?
Well, Psycho would definitely be one. I guess I'll go with Forbidden Planet, which I just like for the sheer strangeness of it.
I do love that but score. That is a great score.
It is a great score. And it's just, you know, it's not that it's fabulous music or even a fabulous film score, but it's just so, you just don't hear people do such unusual stuff. People don't take those kinds of chances anymore. I think I'd probably have to shoot something from Morricone. Well, might as well say The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.